Welcome to Adapted, the podcast where we explore adaptations of various forms. I'm today's host, Tom, and with me is...
Pat, and only Pat.
Yes, we've lost KG for tonight. Hopefully we'll gain him back shortly. We're in pursuit, he's missing, and a eccentric oil millionaire has hired us to find him. So that's what we'll be doing tonight. But... while we do that, we'll be discussing...
What an introduction.
What an introduction, yes. And it transitions us nicely into the main topic of our discussion, Raymond Chandler's 1939 novel, The Big Sleep, and the 1946 film adaptation directed by Howard Hawks with a writing credit from William Faulkner, of all people.
That was when they clearly were bringing in these like famous dudes just to give cred to the script, I'm assuming. Like that was like.
I wonder about that because I mean, how famous was William Faulkner at that point?
He wasn't like, I mean, he didn't win the Nobel Prize for a while. He actually wasn't that well known,
yeah,
but
I think so.
He wasn't like, you know, he'd written some of his major works by that point, but a lot of those works would have dropped off the radar. They were only sort of kept going. Actually, it was like the Modern Library that kept them going for a while. They were the only ones that were keeping it in print. But I think he was well known enough amongst people who knew things that I think that he could be brought on as sort of like cred.
Yeah, I suppose so, because I'm thinking Sound and the Fury is 29, right? 1929.
Yeah, it's 29.
30, I think, is As I Lay Dying. I want to say 30, somewhere between 36 and 38 is Absalom Absalom. And then I think The Hamlet is 1940. So he's like on the downturn by that point.
Yeah, he's written basically all his major stuff that he's going to write, but he never makes a lot of money off it, except for like Sanctuary, I think is the only one he wrote that actually sold reasonably well.
Which wasn't that great. Yeah.
You know, he's not, and it's not great, but you know, he says very openly he wrote it just to make money because he needed money. So he wrote basically a, you know, pop oiler. So I think he was well known enough. Like, I don't know what his equivalent would be nowadays, but he would be someone who's written enough. They're well known. They have a name. They brought him on, I think, to give some cred. So anyway, so yes, technically, I imagine he sprinkled some of the dialogue. Most of it's lifted directly from the book anyway, but I imagine he sort of, you know, some of the scenes with Lauren Bacall, I imagine he added some, you know, local color or whatever.
That yeah, added think some zest into
yeah.
it. Yeah. But in addition to that, we also may touch on other earlier film noirs. Both of us are familiar with both the book and the film of The Maltese Falcon, which was from 1930, and John Huston's film adaptation was from 44, or from 41, I think, not 44, excuse me. And then also we have Raymond Chandler's very famous essay, The Simple Art of Murder, which was published in the Atlantic Monthly in 1944. And so we'll touch on all this or other things that relate to noir and film noir and all of that very good stuff. And this connects from last week. So last week we discussed German Expressionism, the art movement, the stage movement, and how that influenced film. As well as that movement's American cousin in the form of Sophie Treadwell's work. I want to start off by reflecting on what the noir, film noir movement, which is now happening in the early 40s, takes from Expressionism and what film noir actually is. That kind of connection between what we were talking about last week with Expressionism and this new thing in the 40s of film noir. There seems to be some kind of connection here between melodrama, which is this older model, which becomes very, very popular in the 19th century, which I guess we could define as a genre of excess. It's just about big, big, big emotion that seems to ground melodrama. And then that connection between melodrama and noir, and film noir definitely seems to be somewhat melodramatic. There's a quote here from film critic Robert Kolker, and he is talking about melodrama, and he says that it's, quote, melodrama is, quote, about feeling, or more accurately, about provoking emotions, perhaps more intense than what are called for by the story being told. The desire to provoke emotions and for the audience to have them provoked was a driving force in the development of America's cinema's classical style. Circumscribed, predictable, closed, The codes of melodrama can permit exaggerated stories to be told, stories that articulate deep, subjective passion and terrors, which are always contained within the bounds of the master narrative. End quote. And so then this form of melodrama, I'd say it seems to connect through the noir or to expressionism, and that connection between melodrama and expressionism, I see as making the noir. Those things kind of graft together and it becomes film noir. And yeah, this kind of relates to a lot of the expressionism ideas of exaggerated emotion on the canvas and those kind of exaggerated emotions on stage, where it's this very primal or angry type of thing. But when we see with like the rise of Orson Welles and his cinematographer Greg Toland, this fusion of melodrama and expressionism becomes not only an experimental style, it becomes the popular style in Hollywood at this time. And that's my little take on this connection between what we were doing last week and what we were talking about, which is very highfalutin and very artsy and very weird, and a style that became uber popular, right? A style that, while muting the heavier expressionistic elements, allowed these kind of glorious, beautiful, well-dressed, and classy anti-heroes to go to hell while looking exceptionally good doing it. And so that's my connection there. What do you see with the noir and our connection to last week's episode?
I mean, I think you're right. And there's the connection with melodrama is an interesting one because you're right. There's a certain element of noir that is very melodramatic. I think that there's an art I would potentially make the argument. I'd be curious if it plays out next week, when we do Double Indemnity. But I think for this one it does. I think it works, is that it's not necessarily true of the novels. I don't know if the novels would qualify as melodrama per se. Because the emotions actually are pretty muted. Like the situations can be a bit over the top, but they're not, it's really the film that decide. I mean, the film introduces the whole romance. Like there, it's kind of there between what do they call her? Vivian Rutledge in the film. It's kind, which I don't quite know why they made that change. That might be, that's something to ask later. But like why did they have her be married to some other dude that never shows up instead of Rusty Reagan? I didn't
I
quite get that. I didn't
don't
understand that. At
know.
first, I thought it was, oh, they're trying to do it because they want, Humphrey Bogart, they want Marlowe to end up with her. So they didn't want her to be married to somebody who is like still alive, like this whole thing. And then it'd be
Potentially
weird
still
that he.
alive,
Yeah, but then I thought, but they never even say what happened to Rutledge. And it
yes.
actually would be better because at the end, Rusty Reagan is dead. So why did they make that change? It was a weird change to me. But anyway, the whole idea of that sort of, the romance there and a lot of some of the more exaggerated sequences are in the film and they're not as exaggerated, I think, in the book. So there is something about the film is more melodramatic, I would say, than the book is necessarily. It certainly has melodramatic elements, but it's not quite as extreme. But I think that a lot of what noir does, and I think we mentioned this last week, is I think it takes the grammar, the language, sort of the imagery of expressionism and sort of places it in a more, as you said, more melodramatic, but in some ways more realistic setting. Like it's using those shadows, it's using those sort of elements to accentuate a plot in a way that it's using it to accentuate a plot, I guess is the way to think of it, rather than just a character's emotional state per se. You can still get to that emotional state. There's some really great uses of, there's a really good one. I think when they're in one of the house, when they're in that house where the murders happened, and there's some really great sort of lights coming in through windows and sort of those, you get a lot of that, but it's not being done necessarily to sort of like show you that Marlowe is upset about something or feels like he's in a cage, or that a machine is going, is consuming his soul, the machine of commercialism. Like you're not getting that. It's not meant to make a point. It's meant to just create an atmosphere. Not for social points or for a character's social or psychological state per se. That being, and there's great examples of that. The other great one is like the rain. It always rains in noir films, even when they're in LA, and it only rains there like 3 days a year, but it rains constantly there. I think someone said that with the movie Seven. I remember someone was like, "What city are they in? It rains there every day, and con it's like it's dark. The sun never seems to rise in that city, and it's constantly raining in Seven." But that sort of idea that I think that's the biggest thing. It's using the language, it's using the imagery, it's using those things, but not for the same purpose is one of the biggest things.
Yeah, and I agree with you. And I think actually part of this is expressionism, despite its enormous demonstration of emotion, sort of works well with melodrama, because melodrama, in spite of its exaggeration of emotion, is also really interested in realism, oddly enough. I mean, we've talked about this before. Melodrama of the 19th century, it's interested in working class people, and it's interested in not particularly maybe psychologically complicated characters, but simple, heroic characters in situations the audience feels they can imagine themselves in. But the emotions are a little unstrung. They're a little over the top or a little boiled, and they want kind of more realistic sets. And so
Yeah, I mean the
melodrama.
great examples of those would be like Ibsen. Ibsen's plays, I think you could totally qualify that way, right? I mean,
Yeah, and
those are.
they're drawing on melodrama anyway.
Yeah, I think he's that they're melodramatic. Now he's sort of using the form. He is using the form to make like a social point. That's sort of why I think his plays were so successful, because he was taking a form that people were very familiar with and very comfortable with, and then completely subverting what you were expecting it to be. Doll's House is the great example of that. We don't find the ending as shocking because we all know that it's come to be a great piece of, I mean, in some ways feminist, even though Ibsen said it wasn't supposed to be feminist, but it's become essentially a great piece of feminist literature and drama and this kind of stuff. But and so we know, okay, she's clearly going to leave this dude at the end. The audience probably on the first night thought they knew the form that the play was going through, and it was going through all the normal motions of sort of the well-made play and the melodrama. And then you get to that scene at the end, and he completely detonates it, in a completely fair way. If you watch it again, I bet in an audience at the time would go, "How did we not notice that she was going to leave him?" It's put in there constantly, but it's not known until you get to the end what he's going to do with it. And so I think that's he is using the melodrama for that purpose. The thing is, a lot of those 19th century melodramas, they don't people don't see them anymore because they're not that good.
It's the problem with realism. Realism kind of works in a certain milieu, right? It works at a certain social circumstance and at a certain time. And what people think of as realistic in the 1860s, when you have somebody like Auguste Daly writing the most popular plays, which people thought were incredibly realistic, looks laughably silly at this point. And I'm sure even acting in the 1940s, like we look at Humphrey Bogart, he's a realistic actor, so to speak, but that's still very stylized. I mean, for the people at the time, that was
That's true.
realistic.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially if you compare it to, a lot of silent
Marlon
films
Brando.
who've.
Yeah, we're looking at Marlon Brando, or the things that are coming, that Michael Chekhov kind of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And even now, if we look back on Brando, there's performances that are kind of stylized. And then there's the great Brando performances, which are not. But I mean, there's also a world of difference between even early Brando and like Brando from Last Tango in Paris or something like that. There's enough of a time period or a time difference there. So it seems like realism requires the audience to be a contemporary, right? That seems to be part of it.
Yeah, I mean, is it partially just that the actors what the actors are acting to what the audience thinks is natural, even though that's not really natural? Nobody really wants to watch people being natural. People
No, it's
are generally pretty boring. You don't actually want to watch people behaving naturally because they don't do very much and they don't say very much. So, and it takes them a long time to say very, very little. That's sort of like the David Mamet structure, where they never really talk about what they're actually talking about, and so you just sort of get round and round and round and round and round. That's a little bit more naturalistic, but I would still say people don't talk that way in real
Yeah,
life.
it's a means of dealing with the fact that you have to abbreviate the
Yeah.
real. How do you abbreviate the real? And that seems to change from era to era.
Yeah, I think people accept it a certain way, and that's how actors will present it. So yes, you can get past the fact that it comes across to us as sort of the, and now, hey, sugar, we gotta go down. Okay, we're gonna get past that and assume that that was accepted as being more realistic. But I just think the point being that a lot of melodrama from the 19th century wouldn't get performed nowadays. If Doll's House didn't end the way that it did,
It would be
no one
scrapped.
would be watching that. No one would watch it. No one would care. It would be just seen as another show that made its debut in Oslo, and no one ever saw it again. It could have been wildly popular in 1870, and no one saw it again.
The evidence of this is there's a bunch of Ibsen that nobody watches before Doll's House, which was melodrama.
So I think it's just that, a lot of that 19th century stuff kind of goes by the wayside. And so, now we're seeing that sort of resurface in a different form. And I think, the use, I think it's a good observation that they're using these expressionistic elements on top of essentially what is a pretty melodramatic script, but it sort of gives it, I'm not going to say it makes it artsy, but it sort of gives it a depth that gives it a lot more atmosphere than it would have. Like, I think if you imagine Big Sleep without the shadows, and you just kind of imagine it like, I don't know, something like Poirot wandering around, it wouldn't be very good. Like, it would be kind of dumb.
It would be the 1978 version,
I didn't see that one.
which I tried to watch before this show, and I just had to stop after a while. But
I
anyway,
mean, it's well, we can get to it. Yeah, anyway, keep going. We can get to the actual story later, but like,
yeah. But I think what's interesting about this kind of connection here with melodrama, the noir, and whatnot is I want to then jump into, before anything or before our next topic, really the Chandler essay. The Simple Art of Murder, because I think he brings in this other ingredient, and he credits Dashiell Hammett with this, which is Dashiell Hammett made realism an important part of crime novels or murder novels or detective novels. He ends up reluctantly calling them detective novels in that, even though he doesn't like that phrase. And he sees that what he's doing and what Dashiell Hammett's doing, who came before him, is, as he says, like giving murder back to the murderers, but also injecting realism into this stuff. We're no longer dealing with what I think he sees as an unrealistic thing, which is the upper class. I think he's very American. You know, they're both very American in their outlooks, that they just see like the British upper class is not real in a certain
well,
way.
it's, I think they
And
see
it's,
it as it's an artificial construction,
yeah.
that's not, and then the especially right in 1940s American, that upper class, the idea of an aristocracy is artificial. Aristocracies are fake. They're not real. You can't actually base anything on them because it's a false construct to begin with. So why do we care?
Yeah. And so then the Poirot murders, which are I think he finds just kind of unconnected to anything any reader actually experiences, are becoming dull. I think he calls British writers they're not the best writers, but they're the best writers of dull material. They're the
Yeah,
best dull
they're the
writers.
dull writers. Yeah, they're the best dull writers. Okay.
which is absolutely
I mean,
great.
he's got a number of quips in there. He's the one, by the way, I quoted it a few times. I couldn't remember who said it at the time. Now I found it when I reread the essay. I'm like, oh, that's who said it. Is the Sherlock Holmes isn't really a character. He's just, an attitude with a few, snappy catchphrases. That's Chandler who's saying that, so.
Yeah, he says that in this essay. And so it's this kind of injection of realism into what he sees as a dull, contrived genre, which is really interesting when you see the detective fiction of the 40s, really the detective fiction that comes out of people like him and Dashiell Hammett as being not, it doesn't have the same sort of problems of unrealism that you see, or unrealism isn't a word, the unrealistic problems that you might see in a Poirot or in Sherlock Holmes. It feels more real because it feels grittier, but the style is very, the visual style, and this is definitely not drawing from realism, which goes to your point, Pat. This idea of expressionism as an influence becomes entirely a consequence of adaptation. That these stories adapt really well. They're really entertaining. You could put them on screen. They're just long enough to get under 2 hours. They really draw you in. They have these cool anti-hero characters, which became really popular around the time of World War II for probably obvious reasons. And though Chandler sees what he's doing as injecting needed realism into something that's kind of dying, or he saw as dying, what ends up happening with adaptation is people like Orson Welles and John Huston, who are a little more stage conscious, they're conscious of what's going on stage, see this thing that is no longer really working on stage. People aren't doing it on stage, and that's their means of adapting it, which is to put realistic stories into this sort of kind of creepy jungle-like otherworldly atmosphere. And so it's this really, really interesting consequence of adaptation. It's not in the books, as you're saying, Pat, but it is this the means by which these things are transformed from book into film. And so it's a really interesting time because these, I think this is kind of the melodrama, the expressionism, and this insistence on making this genre more real converge into a new type of unreality that I think is quite unexpected, especially if you're just reading Sherlock Holmes or Chesterton or Agatha Christie.
I would say this is the first film, and I think Maltese Falcon is the first one in this, but it's the first one we've done where the work's adaptation is, not to say that it's better than the novel, but it's very, very different, and it's a new thing. It's sort of a totally different, and again, I actually like the book Big Sleep more than the movie, but it's a new great thing. It's a new sort of art form. A lot of these sort of adaptations essentially are sort of just that. They're just or they're just sort of translations. I think we used that phrase last year. You know, they're more translations necessarily than they are adaptations. This is a translations of Poirot from one setting, you know, one medium to another medium. They're sort of just, and they're using film, and they kind of use film shortcuts, and they use film, you know, sort of things there. And sometimes Poirot is a little kooky, and sometimes he's a little more grounded, and sometimes he's annoying and Tom doesn't like him, but you know he's th that's more what they are. This is taking the Big Sleep, which is a very, very, very good novel, you know, and train and actually adapting it, doing something, ta adding new elements to it and making something new that is also really good, that's not totally what the book is and not totally what the movie is. You kind of need both. And that, I think it feels like the first one where we've really had that type of true adaptation.
Yes, yeah, where the medium transforms the material.
Yes,
It
that's a
doesn't just
very good
reflect
way to
it,
phrase it.
it
Yes, that's a
transforms
very good way
into
to phrase it. You didn't translate it from one medium to another medium. You adapted it for that medium in a new way. I think that's a good way to phrase it. Yeah.
Yeah, I think the Maltese Falcon, especially, because it's earlier and it's also more distinct. The shadows are particularly long. The streets of San Francisco are sort of hard. They're not unrealistic, but you don't exactly know where you are in any given scene. They're not that interested in that. You see, like Spade and Archer, the shadow of the name of their office is on the floor in the opening, and it's a very famous image because it's spread out and what have you. And technically, that could be realistic, but it's really very much stylized. And that's when you begin to feel it. And it kind of, I think, culminates with something like Touch of Evil from in the late 1950s, which is it's a noir that's really stylized and really weird. And there's a lot of Dutch angles, and it's very playful. It's not an adaptation of anything, I don't think that was a book originally.
Not that I know of, but
Yeah, but it's certainly a thing that couldn't exist without film. In a way that any Agatha Christie, you know, that really could exist without film, right? You could kind of read those scripts and get the same
well,
thing.
to your point, I mean, I think you gave the really good example, which I had never really thought about it when we were reading it. We were talking about the lighting, you know, and sort of the television thing where it's just like overlighted, just get lots of light on it, just act out the scene. No one really cares how this thing looks. We're here to watch Poirot be brilliant and make quips about his little gray cells and, you know, talk about vegetable marrows. Like we're here for that. We're not here for anything else. You can't, I haven't seen the 70, is it 78 version?
78,
I
yes.
haven't seen that one, but you can't do that with Philip Marlowe. You can't do that with Big Sleep. If you just go and take this movie and plop it on a screen with lots of overlit lights just because you need to get the thing on a stage, it will be unbelievably stupid. It just doesn't work. I think it would be dumb. So you have to rework this thing to get it out there. The ABC Murders was fine. We watched it. It was fine. I don't think anyone would want to watch The Big Sleep done in the same way, like a television made for television movie. I think it would be a disaster.
Yeah, I agree. And maybe the less said about that. To be fair, I did not finish the 78 version, so maybe it's brilliant in its second hour. It's closer to the book, but they've moved the movie from California to England, like north of England, and it's sometimes a city, sometimes not, but it's a much more comfortable space to live in. Although it follows the book, outside of that, it follows the book much closer than the Howard Hawks adaptation.
Which to me
But
is, but to me that's dumb
yeah,
because the whole
it's
thing.
irrelevant. I'm just
Well,
mentioning
it's
it.
also just, I mean, this is another one of those movies, and I always hate that stereotype where people are like, the city itself is the character. New Orleans is a character in this, but I've never really bought that. But the setting matters. I just think this is an urban story. If you want to translate it from LA to Chicago, fine. But this is an urban story. I don't think if you tran you have to have that, the claustrophobia, the anonymity, the sort of the cars moving in it. You have to have that quality that someone can just walk into a store and sort of vanish, that you just don't get if you're not in a city. That quality goes missing.
Yeah, and there's exceptions to this. And I think two that come to mind are Robert Altman's adaptation of Marlowe with The Long Goodbye, which is very sunny. And the other one is Chinatown. Chinatown is really sunny. It's still LA, and it still has the dangers of a city. There's a lot of things that relate to the city bureaucracy that kind of come out and eat you. But it's still a sunny space, right? It's still a kind of happy space
It's
that
not that you have to have shadows, but I say, A, you have to have a city because it has to have that sense of anonymity. And I think you are making more of the point. It's not the shadows necessarily, it's the stylization. I think you need to have a strong sense of style that, say, the ABC Murders didn't
Doesn't
have. It
have, yeah.
doesn't have that. That doesn't have a strong sense of style. Chinatown has a strong sense of style.
Yeah.
It's not just, let's follow this story for the plot to see Philip Marlowe solve the case. The story is a bit outlandish and doesn't totally make sense all the time, and it doesn't matter. That's not why you're there. I think there's, and again, I can't remember if it's in Simple Out of Murder, but he says it. Someone says this, one of these mystery writers, whether it was Hammett or whether it was Chandler, who says something like, "Yeah, the problem with writing mystery stories is that for a lot of them, once you get to the end, you're only going to read it once because you're only reading it to find out who the murderer is or who committed the crime. And once you figured it out, well, who cares? No one's ever going to go back and reread it. No one's ever going to buy it and read it again. No one cares. You're only reading it for that purpose." He said he was trying, and again, I can't remember if it was Hammett or Chandler, but they're similar philosophies. I think they're going from. They were not trying to write stories with that in mind. They were trying to write stories that you didn't even really care. It's almost like Twin Peaks. You didn't even really care who the murderer was. You were there for everything else. You were there for the characters and the situations and the city and the atmosphere. That's what you were there for. You were there for those kind of things. It might have been film, actually. It might have been film, actually, when they were talking about it, that they didn't like. It was a producer of films, actually, now that I think about it, who was saying the problem is people don't go see murder mysteries twice. They only go see them once because they're only going to go see them to see who the murderer was, and then they don't go, and they wanted to get repeat people. And so these films ask for repeat viewings. The ABC Murders does not ask for a repeat viewing. The Big Sleep does. You can easily go watch that again, and I imagine someone could go see it in 1940 and go see it again in, was it 44, 41,
46, I think it is.
46? So it's after the war. Okay, 46, which would make sense. So it's after 46. You could go see it in 46. You could go see it a few weeks later. You could see that movie multiple times and still enjoy it because you're not really there to see, to find out who murdered the person. Half the time, you can't even remember who did it.
Yeah,
In
and
some of
there's
these,
it, so many people die
yeah, and
that
so
you know.
you're not really, you're not told. I watching it, watching The Big Sleep, I can't imagine most people, if they hadn't read the book and watched, sat down in the movie theater in 1946, had any idea what was going on. Like, I
Yeah.
don't think, t 20 minutes into that, you're like, why is he tailing this dude? Who is this? Whose house are they at? Why were the books being moved? Like, you're just like, what
Yeah.
is this? And then, it's like, okay, now he's picked the daughter up. She was there. why was she there? And then, and then someone else gets murdered, and who shows up? This guy's important now. Like, there's no way you're following this plot. You're not meant to. The plot's not what you're there for, I don't think.
And I think it's another quality of adaptation. One of the things you're there for is Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall, which
Yes.
is why one of the big changes is her character, regardless of what her name is, has a much bigger role to play in this than in the book. You get this, they're a romantic pair. They're not in the book at all. And sometimes it works. I mean, there's the one scene with the Laurel and Hardy skit with the cops on the telephone. I could have done without that scene, but regardless, that is an adaptation choice to recognize we're here to see the style, but also the style is the beautiful people. Look at what they're wearing. Look how good they are together. Look at them. Look at Lauren Bacall's face. I mean, I've said this before with Murder on the Orient Express. You could just stare at that face all day. I mean, that would be a reason to go back, is to see her again, or to see how cool Humphrey Bogart looks when he does everything. Even when he kicks someone in such a weak fashion, you can't imagine it does anything, and it knocks the guy clear out cold. That's fine, whatever. The stylization of it ends up becoming why you come back. And it's interesting to think of people seeing this as realistic and us watching it. I don't really see this as realistic, and I don't care at all. I love the style of it. I love that it looks better than what would really be happening. I love that their relationship doesn't make a lick of sense, that these people should get together. And it's obviously can never work out. I mean, imagine this relationship working out in any capacity between, the daughter of an oil tycoon and this like pseudo, he's not a low life, but he has the income of a low life, we'll say that. And
Well, he's connected with the low life. You know, that's sort of one of the ideas, especially in this, as we get more and more into the 20th century, that the detective's always been on the outside. He's always supposed to have been a little weird. He's not quite a member of culture and society, but Poirot can be invited to go on the fancy boat, and he's fine. He can wear a tux and look nice and do all this kind of stuff. Philip Marlowe ain't doing that. Like, Philip
No.
Marlowe is never going to do that. He's in even Holmes. Like, you could see if Holmes ever had to go meet the Queen, it would be fine. Philip Marlowe ever has to go meet the president, he's gonna be blowing smoke in his face. That's what the character is, and so you're not gonna get the same. He's connected with crime, and it rubs off on him. He carries some of that taint with him, and you get that more and more and more. And I think to your, this is what we were saying earlier. Why has the anti-hero become so much bigger? Because he gets things done, and that there is evil in this world, and somebody's got to go out there and just deal with that evil. And maybe the means in which they keep everybody else safe is not always the best. Is not always total strictly above board, let's say, and they have to do it. And it keeps everybody else safe. This is a sacrifice they make for everybody else. That's almost this idea that's going on here. And so his yeah, you're right. He's never going to end up with her because he's too, unless he's going to give up what he does, and he can't do that because it's what he is.
And I mean, this speaks to something in Chandler's work and something you mentioned about the visual icon in the opening of the book, which is that the detective has to be this knight in shining armor, and he's not quite the armor isn't quite shining. It's a little faded, it's a little dusty, it's a little nicked, but the detective is the good but
His
tough
armor is his
man.
wit, Tom. His armor is his shining wit.
His competency, his armor is his
Yes, his
competency.
armor is his competency. He's very good, and that's why we like him. Yeah.
And I mean, Chandler describes it as the detective is the person who offers tragedy its redemptive narrative. It's not quite a broken world because we have the detective who can move between classes and get things done, right? He's the knight who makes it safe. And you mentioned this, and I had forgotten this in the opening of this book, when he goes into the it's the general, right? He's not a
General, yeah.
colonel, he's a general. He goes
General.
into the
Is he
general's.
actually General Sternwood? Yes, I think
General,
General
yeah, I
Sternwood.
keep forgetting if
It's
it's
General Sternwood.
Colonel or General. But
It's
anyway,
General.
he goes into his home, and there's that kind of stained glass of the night, right? Which I don't think is in the movie. In the 78 movie, in the hallway, there's a bunch of knights, like knight armor set up, so it's, just on the head, which is fine. But yeah, he's that kind of knight who has to go through the dangerous forest and save the day. And at one point, Chandler compares him to Galahad. I think Lancelot's a better comparison because, like, Lancelot's sort of part of the meanness of the world. Like, Lancelot sins pretty distinctly. But whatever. I mean, this doesn't really matter. What matters is that he, for Chandler and for Hammett too, he's the person who he's the person who makes these worlds tragic, not ironic. Like, ironic, to use the Canadian critic Northrop Frye's term, is that's a broken world. An ironic world is just broken. It's not going to be put back together. It really needs to go through this kind of Viconian cycle and be flushed away. A tragic world is a world
What
that
would you call an
falls.
iconic world? Like, what's an
An
example that you would give?
ironic.
Ironic, excuse me, ironic
I
world.
would
What's an example that
say,
you would give?
let's say, like in a really ironic movie, something like American Psycho, which is a disgusting movie and an even more disgusting book. But that is a world that doesn't work. It's destroyed. It's completely horrible. Nothing good will happen in that world. And it's not really tragic or comic. It's a failed world. It's not a big Hollywood thing because showing people an utterly failed world and horrible characters just doesn't work. I think movies like Kids, I can't remember the name of that director, but it's like a bunch of horrible children with AIDS. Like, give other kids AIDS for fun.
That sounds like a great movie.
Yeah, it's not worth anyone's time ever. But I mean, these are kind of, I think, ironic worlds. These are worlds that cannot be forgiven. And there's no moral home, there's no moral center. They're kind of Nietzschean almost. But I don't think that's these worlds. I think these worlds are tragic in the sense of, not in the classic sense where the hero dies and what have you, but in the sense that there is a redemptive thing that can survive, and that's the detective. The fact that he only takes one case at a time, that he is actually squeaky clean, that when Sam Spade turns in Bridget at the end of Maltese Falcon, it's the right thing to do. Even though he doesn't want to do it, it's not what he it is condemning the person he loves. Maybe to death, and also he loses financially at the same time, yet it is the right thing to do. And I think maybe Maltese Falcon is a
He
better
also
example.
does it. He does it, though, also, I would say, right. He does do it for quite, kind of the right reasons. But one of the main reasons, the arguments he gives, is that it would also make him a sucker. Like, that's also an important thing to realize, is that it's a world in which it's not necessarily just doing the right thing. It's not playing the sucker, not being the one who gets played for the fool. And I think you could that the argument that's being made in Maltese Falcon, I think to some extent, is that if Sam Spade doesn't turn her in, he's gonna play the sucker because she's gonna use him at some point, and he knows that, and she'll hold it. I think he says, he's like, "You'll hold
You'll
it
hold
over
it
me.
for me my whole
You'll hold it
life.
over me the whole time, and that means I'm playing the sucker, and I won't play the sucker. I won't play the sucker for you."
Yeah. But when you start playing the sucker, then you're pulled down. Right? That's so many men in this world fail to make it better because they're weak. They're playing the sucker. They're weak. This is not a world that tolerates weak men. It's a world of knights. And so if you
That's fair,
want
yeah.
to redeem the world, you have to be not just good, and do the right thing. You can't be a sucker, i.e., you have to be strong. You have to
Yeah,
be
no, that's fair, yeah.
willing to fight. And so I think that's where this is a little different. That's where, that's where all the grittiness and whatnot. I think focusing on the grit and what have you sort of misses what Chandler is doing, which is he's looking at a world that went through the Depression and then went through the war or the wars, and is really kind of alienated by this growing urban thing, which is a pretty recent phenomenon, even in the 1940s, that everybody's now living in a city. That's, the mechanization is a 19th century phenomenon, but it wasn't until the 20th century where you had more Americans in cities than not. And in spite of this, there is this kind of moral center he's able to find, but it requires a new type of man. And that's what, or maybe even an old type of man. You have to go back to these kind of Arthurian models in order to deal with this world. And it's also really American, which I like. Like, there's no time. Like, upper class, lower class, they all suck. They're all part of the
Yes, yeah,
same
there's that.
pile of crap. I sort of like that. You wouldn't really find, you find that maybe a little bit in Holmes, but no one's critiquing the Queen in Sherlock Holmes.
I mean, you find that the upper class has foibles, you know, even or has done bad things, you know, even with what's his name, the king of Bohemia or whatever in the Scandal of Bohemia. You know, even Holmes says, he's like, well, you're kind of a douche, and you know, you should feel bad about what you've done. But yeah, there's no sense here that there is still a, there's almost a sense that you should have known better because you are better. You should have known better how to handle this situation rather than you're the same as me, and we're all kind of just, yeah, as you say, we're all just piles of refuse. This sort of idea that we're all struggling with our own problems, that, you know, that's not there.
And Chandler does have more than just the hero as a good guy. When you read through his book, you've read all of his books. I've not read all of them yet. I'm almost there. There are definitely characters beyond Marlowe who are good.
Yes.
There's definitely he finds lots of people for Marlowe to connect with, and part of them in this is the general. The
The
general is a
general's very good. I
good
mean, that's
man.
the important, and you know, there is, this is the whole thing, is Marlowe is, or Chandler is pretty wildly misogynistic in a certain extent. That's, you know, I think that's something we can discuss on the next one. But for him, the only really meaningful relationship is between two men. Like, that's the meaningful. So the meaningful relationship, the relationship that drives the entire story, and that's the difference between this and the movie, that the is not a relationship between Marlowe and any woman. It's Marlowe and the general. That's what drives the story. If Marlowe doesn't have a connection with the general, the whole story falls apart. He doesn't care anymore. That's why he's doing all the things he's doing, because he likes the general. And he wants the general's questions to be answered, and he doesn't want the general to have to find out how terrible his daughters are. That's the meaningful relationship there, and that's very, very frequently true in Chandler's books, that the meaningful relationships are between men.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I'm thinking of Farewell, My Lovely, the scene where they go onto the boat and he finds that red-headed ex-cop who takes him on there, and that's the most meaningful connection he makes in that. And that person is the wisest as well in all of the books. He does have that friendship with the reporter in that book, I think, who's a female character.
That's true, yeah.
Yeah, but it's she's not given a lot.
It's not to say the women
Yeah.
can't be competent,
But it's not the main
but
connections.
it's not the main that the you know, there is sort of this idea, again, going back to this knight thing, the knight, you know, there is sort of this idea that the ideal knight is a celibate. There is almost this idea that Marlowe is sort of celibate. You never really see him have any strong romantic relationships until the last novel, the one that he wrote, and that's like pretty much a disaster. He rarely has a strong romantic relationship that lasts for very long, and it's really true in Maltese Falcon too. There is a romantic relationship, but that's not the important thing. He doesn't really have a male sort of relationship. It's not quite as big of a deal for him. But when we get to Double Indemnity, that's the big thing that changes, is that, and that's what Chandler didn't really like about James M. Cain's work, is he doesn't like how the relationships work. And so he sort of has he's sort of altering it in this sense. But I think that, yeah, there are other good people. And you're right, the general is the perfect example in this one, that the general is the best other person. There's this sense that this is a guy who deserves better than he has gotten. And I think, and he's strong, or he was strong. He knows what's right. He knows what he should do in situations. Like, he's a competent man, but he's lost all his physical strength, so now he needs to rely on others to get it done for him. But I think you're right. There's other good people in this world. Oftentimes the cops are good. He usually has a decent amount of respect for the cops. Like, they're sometimes a little crooked. Like, I think there's the great line, and you know, he's like, I'm a little crooked, but only as crooked enough to say I need to get by. There's sort of this sense that, well, they have to be a little crooked in order to get their jobs done and make enough money, but you know, they're good people. That's often true with a number of the characters. Even Elijah Cook Jr.'s character is sort of, he's a little weak, but he's good. You know, that's the big thing, is he doesn't give up Agnes in the, you know, he doesn't give her up. He goes to his death rather than really reveal it. You know, so he sort of gets sent off with a in a positive way. He sort of gets sent off in a positive light.
I think, do we want to talk about, I agree, do we want to move to the ending of the book? I mean, compare it to the movie, because that's a big change. So the ending, for people who don't remember or haven't watched it, or excuse me, read it, we find the younger sister killed this guy Philip's looking for, basically because she came on to him and he did not reject, and he rejected her advances. Which it seems like Regan, the character who sparks this, it's somebody Marlowe's looking for who's disappeared. He seems like he was one of these good men also. He seems like he was not a competent, he was a drug runner. He fought for the Irish Republican Army at one point, and that seems to be something we're supposed to admire in this world. And what we discover is the sister of his wife came on to him, he rejected her, and this woman who's crazy in ways that are kind of hard to describe. She seems like a violent sociopathic child. I get that
Yeah, I
impression.
think that's what he's going for, yeah.
Just kills him almost without thinking, right? I think the general describes her as she's coy and will pull the wings off flies. That end, it's a really, really strange ending. And Marlowe sort of deduces that she's done this, and he gives her a gun to make her think that she has a gun. And obviously, there's no bullets in it. And she pulls the gun on him, and he sort of goes to her sister and is like, okay, I'm not going to go to the police, but you have to fix this. She needs to go to an institution or something. And it's a very strange ending. Of the four books of his I've read so far, I think Farewell, My Lovely, I enjoy the most. I think this ending, though, is my favorite, because it's so strange. The result of this mystery, the result of this mystery is that this, at the center of it, is this kind of absolute lunatic who just killed someone because she was like a little upset about it. It wasn't for money, it wasn't for pornography, or it wasn't for any of the other reasons, or even love, really. She didn't love this guy. It was just, she kind of got a little frustrated. It's a really dark ending. And yeah, I liked it a lot, but I was wondering what you made of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a few, you know, when I was watching the movie, it struck, I think it's just kind of funny because it's ironic. There's certainly a level of irony that, because he asks at one point, I can't remember the butler's name is Norris or something like that, and he says he's like, does Norris know? And she's like, yeah, he knows. And he's like, yeah, I thought he knew. It's just ironic because I love the fact that the very first two people he meets are Norris and then Carmen, and so it's like the very first two people that he meets the entire are two of the only people that know everything. Because Norris actually knows basically the whole story. He's the only one who knows the entire, basically the whole breakdown. He is fully aware of what's going on. There's certainly, and Carmen is too, but she's just a complete psycho, and so she doesn't totally get it all. I just think there's certainly a level of irony in that. I mean, I think there is, again, there's the one of the main themes of this, I think, is that oftentimes, and I think this is less true, it's there in Dashiell Hammett, but I think it's really true here, that one of the things that destroys great men are, in Chandler's world, are women. That's oftentimes is that's what destroys them, because they're chasing after some woman, and therefore that causes their downfall, you know, or a woman who's chasing after them causes their downfall, in the case of like Rusty Regan, or whatever they call them. Yeah, they call him Rusty Regan in the book and something else in the movie. I'm guessing Rusty was dead to like connotations of some sort, so they couldn't go with it. I don't know
They
why
go
they
with
changed his name.
Regan. They
They went with Regan, but they got rid of Rusty. I didn't know if it was like in they had to change the name of, like, in Graham Greene's third man of the main character, because like the main character's head name had like connotations in America, so they were like, oh, we can't use that, we can't use that word, to like change it. So I don't know if there was something like that, but anyway, so they changes his name. But it's true with him, it's true with Elijah Cook Jr.'s character, whatever his name is. You know, that character is chasing after Agnes. It's essentially true of the chauffeur, because he was chasing after Carmen. It's just so many of these people who die. Oftentimes they're dying because essentially they are chasing after some woman or some woman's chasing after them, which is why I think he's making a point about that with the Marlowe character. That's why Marlowe, it doesn't make sense, at least the adaptation that they do in the movie, to have him chasing after Lauren Bacall. It makes no, you know, as far as Chandler's work's concerned, that change doesn't make sense. I think that directly contradicts some of the themes of it, that there is this idea of like you need to essentially be celibate. You need to reject this whole thing. You cannot be distracted. This will destroy you. I think there's an element of that in these books. But yeah, I mean, as far as the ending goes, it is a really weird, it's a weird ending because Big Sleep is one of the ones, more so than the others, where it sort of has that like, oh, it's over. He's solved the mystery. And then it's like, nope, it's gonna keep going. He's gonna keep finding because there's some thread that hasn't actually been fully answered. And you just keep going and going and going and going. And yeah, it ultimately boils down to the question that he wasn't hired to figure out, but everyone assumed he was hired to figure out, which is where is Rusty Regan? And that actually is the ending of the book. He was not asked to find it out. Everyone assumed it was, but that's what he actually ends up sort of settling on. And so you just keep going. I remember when I first read it, kind of thinking like, this is weird. Why is he taking her out to the shooting range? You know, and I'm like, this is weird. He seemed to have rejected her previously. I don't get. And then you sort of are like, oh, I did not see that coming. And it doesn't have that false. This is, I guess, is the big thing. It doesn't have that false like, it's because either the Holmesian thing, which is, or even the Auguste Dupont, like I found a piece of monkey hair up the chimney. And that's how I saw it. You're like, oh, well, that's cheap. You know, so it doesn't have that quality. It doesn't have, you know, the quality of a Holmes one where it's like, I found a particular type of tobacco char, or, you know, the Poirot ones where you dropped your handkerchief and H in Russian, it actually makes an N sound. Like, it doesn't have those kind of clue elements to it. I'm not even entirely certain if you read The Big Sleep, you could ever. It's not a puzzle mystery. I don't think you ever could figure it out. You're not meant to figure it out per se. Maybe you could piece it together as you went. I don't think you're meant to, though. So it has sort of a revelatory character to it, but the, I guess just less of the inevitability about it. There's less this sense of sort of inevitability of like, oh, that was the clue I was missing. You're sort of it doesn't really have that sense to it, which is different from the other crime things we've done so far.
And it also delves more into the individual psychology. Poirot claims to do that in the works, that he's now thinking about how a person thinks or whatnot. That never seems to be evident, and it never seems to have anything to do with how he
No, he'll
actually
always just be
solved
like, no, mon ami, that is not the psychology. And I'm like,
it.
why not? Like, do people do stupid stuff? That happens all the time. That's not unusual. So why do we reject the claim that they would do it now?
And in
But
this, it's the psychology. This psychology comes back into it, how people act and whatnot. That's how you know Joe Brody isn't a killer, because Joe Brody just isn't the type of person who could kill people, the blackmailer, right? They think that possibly he's a killer. He's not the type of guy who can kill people. And so there is this sort of insight that Marlowe has into types of people, just because he's worked in so many different worlds. But it ends, I think what was striking for me was that it ends on this moment of like psychological weirdness, where you cannot get into this person's head. This person is so alien to the rest of us that the only thing you could do is just lock her away. That's it. There's no, like, even a competent man can't really solve this problem. This is really outside of all of us. And it's much creepier. We get a little bit of this in High Window, where there's like this kind of weird psychological game that's being played. It's just not as interesting, and it also has this kind of cuddly ending where he takes her home to her parents, and they write him letters about how nice it is that she's been home after 8 years or something like that. But that was what I found so very disturbing about this was, you get these revelations into who these people are, and Marlowe's able to manage them. Even the like really crazy guy at the end, the tough guy who's hiding away Eddie Mars's wife, I don't remember his name. But even there, like, that's the most brutal
Anna or
guy.
something, isn't it? What is his name?
So, yeah, I don't
I remember it's
remember.
something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, but
Anyway.
he's the most brutal person, and
Yes.
Marlowe's able to handle that. And then in the end, we just get this very, very, very alien thing that happens. I think that's why, I liked Farewell, My Lovely more, just because I think the setting is so much more interesting in Farewell, My Lovely. You're just moving into these spaces, and this like random jacked guy is occasionally
It's
shows
such a
up.
great opening. It's just such a good opening. Like, that's the great one. It's just this random jack dude shows up and just murders someone.
And there's this one part where he's like locked in a hospital and he's trying to
Yeah.
break out of the hospital, and the guy's just there. And it has not, it's not, he doesn't need to be there for the plot. It's just has this kind of hallucinogenic quality, that scene where he's like been drugged up and he's trying to get out, and this jacked murderer guy is just lying in bed reading a magazine. That book is really fun. But this is the, I think, most disturbing of the books I've read. This moment is the most disturbing. And it is, I think, to your point, it's kind of bungled in the adaptation because you have to show Bogey and Bacall get together, because that's really why everybody
Yeah,
wants to come.
that's what everyone was there. Yeah. My understanding is they rewrote parts of it after they got together, that they like redid little bits of it to make their relationship more. That's why with like the Laurel and Hardy thing came in. I will bet anything that there was like, people really like Bogey and Bacall. We gotta get another scene. And they're like, make a scene where they call the cops, like, and do this, then do the cutesy thing. Like, people will die over it. And I bet anything those are the kind of scenes that got like stacked in there.
Yeah, the scene where they're at dinner, where it starts out flirtatious and then it kind of turns to more of an
Where's Regan?
interrogation.
Yeah, what is he got on you? What is Eddie Moss got on you?
Yeah, that starts off as kind of a flirtation. They apparently added that in. That scene was
Oh,
just
that was
added
added.
in.
Okay.
Probably the phone call thing was added in too. I don't know for a fact, but I know that scene was added in like years after, because
Oh, interesting.
they were like people like this couple, and they actually did become a couple. And so in response to these people becoming a couple, you want to see them become a couple on screen. And so it has this kind of weird symbiosis between the actors' actual lives and the movie they're making, which, yeah, as you say, it sort of violates Chandler's pattern. But if an adaptation is about style, if noir is about style over story or even psychological depth of character, then that's sort of honest to the spirit of the adaptation, to the thing that transforms it, is we're going to deal with these actually glamorous people and treat that as the central thing we want to see, or we know the audience wants to see.
And I don't know, maybe it would be because it's essentially if you don't have the, I don't like The Omen. I don't like this is as far as adaptations go, this is not my favorite adaptation. I really like The Big Sleep. I like the book, I like the movie. I don't really like it as an adaptation. But if you go to say The Maltese Falcon again, that it'll be a lot closer to The Maltese Falcon. Essentially there's this, it's he's obviously not throwing Lauren Bacall in prison at the end of it, but there is this element of he's gonna be alone at the beginning, he's gonna be alone at the end. That's there. And that is essentially what the book is. I mean, I think he goes to like a diner and tries to have a cup of coffee and he's all depressed because he's thinking about the big sleep and how we all die. That's essentially how it ends. And so it has a very different tone to it, that I think would probably have made a better movie. But it would have been a very different movie. It sort of would have just been M much similar to the Maltese Falcon. So maybe it's better to have it this way. And I think it certainly made it more popular. I can understand why they did it. They didn't just want to make another Maltese Falcon. They wanted to make something different and they wanted to highlight their stars and make sense.
There you go. So I could mention the 1978 adaptation.
I
It's
didn't watch it. I need to watch it.
loaded with stars. It's Robert Mitchum is
Oh, I like Mitchum.
Marlowe.
Must have
Jimmy
been
St
old. He must have been old by then.
he was
78.
yeah he's looking old. Jimmy Stewart is the general.
That makes sense. Yeah, Jimmy Stewart was playing. I mean, it's funny. He's 78. He's lived for another 20 years. He was
Yeah, I
playing.
guess
Oh, he was playing old people well into
for
the
a
90s.
while.
Yeah, because he was in that. Was it not Magnolias or something? What was the movie that he was in?
No, you're thinking of Illusions. They're all pipe dreams.
No, I know that one. I know he was obviously in
Magnolia. He was in Magnolia. Pipe Dreams guy was.
Magnolia.
Yeah,
Yeah,
but that was
you
Pipe
just.
Dreams guy. That wasn't Jimmy Stewart. Unless Jimmy Stewart was
Oh
also
my
in that
gosh, you're
movie.
right. I'm thinking you're totally right. I was thinking wrong. I
Yeah,
mixed them up.
Robards. Yeah.
Robards. I mixed up Robards and Jimmy Stewart. You said Jimmy Stewart, and I was thinking Jason Robards.
Yeah.
Okay, Jimmy Stewart, much more interesting. Okay, you said Jimmy Stewart. I heard Jason Robards.
Yeah, well, honestly, I kind of like Jason Robards more, but you know what?
Yeah.
Actually, Jason Robards would be good in that role.
Yeah, that's why I was like, oh, Jason Robards would be really cool as the
Yeah.
general. That's a great. Oh, Jimmy Stewart's terrible at that. That's not a
I
good fit.
mean, it was fine. I mean, he's not in it that much. It's also the whole movie is just sort of slothful. It's just lazy. It just nobody seems to have any energy. Marlowe doesn't seem that interested in what he's doing, but it is
Well,
I
this is the, you know, that's always the if you're trying to play the cool guy who never cares about anything, you can't play it that way because then it just it's boring. You know, you have to always you can't that's not you can't play it that way.
Any other ideas we want to put forward about Chandler, The Big Sleep, Noir, Expressionism, the history of the world?
This is, as I've said before, this is like one of my favorite periods. It's fun to talk about because I think I find new things as we talk about it, but I think we've gotten a lot of it. I think between last week and this week, we've hit a lot of the high points. I think Double Indemnity will be an interesting. Double Indemnity is an interesting discussion because they change stuff between The Big Sleep, the book and the movie, but it's mostly around the whole Bogie Bacall thing, and it's that's sort of totally understandable. The stuff they change between the book Double Indemnity and the movie Double Indemnity, because Chandler wrote the script, and so Chandler changes a lot, and it's a very different movie than the book, I would say.
I'm excited to talk about that next week. If you enjoyed The Big Sleep and are looking for more adaptations of The Big Sleep, check out the 1978 version of The Big Sleep, a film so soporific that if you make it through the picture without falling asleep, Robert Mitchum will rise from the grave and give you and your family a gift certificate to Chili's. You can rate and review this show anywhere fine podcasts are available. For those viewing in YouTube land, if you haven't already, please like this video, subscribe to the Talking Studios channel for all our exciting content, and follow us on social media at Talking Studios. Check out other shows by Talking Studios, including Talking Pictures Trivia, where we explore movies through trivia, Keep Making Movies, where we explore micro-budget films, Limited Lexicon, where we play through text-based adventure games, and Get the Point, where we slowly reveal a movie poster and try to guess which movie poster it is. Got a question for us? Call the Talking Studios hotline at 201-467-8679 and leave a message. It may be featured on a future episode. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to Adapt It, wherever fine podcasts are found. Join us next time when we discuss Cruel Spaces with James M. Cain's Double Indemnity and Billy Wilder's film adaptation.
Wow, Talking Studios.
Next week, we'll be discussing Inverted Spaces with Double Indemnity. Pat, if you could adapt Double Indemnity into any medium, what would it be?
So I thought of a few different ones. Like I was trying to think of like Double Indemnity, like the computer adventure game, which I don't think would work that well, or like Double Indemnity, the board game. Like everything's board game nowadays. But I finally settled on the spin-off show with Edward G. Robinson as the main character. And so it would be a whole series of Edward G. Robinson, sort of like you know, going doing all of his investigations. I think that would be fun mostly, but the thing is, it has to actually be Edward G. Robinson, which so it doesn't work anymore. Because I don't really want to see anybody else actually play the character. I just want to see Edward G. Robinson. So that would be my spin-off. What about you, KJ?
Well, hang on. Who's Edward G. Robinson?
He's the
He's the
investigator.
yeah.
He's the
He's
insurance. He's
Keys.
the
Keys.
actor who
He's
plays.
the
Oh,
actor who plays
oh,
Keys.
oh.
He's the actor who plays Keys.
Got it. Got it. So it's kind
So
of like
I don't really care
Columbo or
about
something,
Keys. I
but
just want to see Edward G. Robinson do it. Yeah,
spoof
that's what does Edward G. Robinson do?
So my dad used to talk about growing up with his brother, and maybe the other kids in the neighborhood, and they play, I don't know, wiffle ball or throw the stick. It was a long time ago. I don't know, whatever it was. And they said it would be like wiffle ball, regular rules, except if you hit the ball and it hit the telephone pole, then the driveway, then the grass, automatic win. Or if you hit the car, the road, the curb, and then caught it, automatic win. So these crazy, unlikely scenarios, there was always one way that you could end the game and win immediately. So I'd love it if the MLB, NFL, NHL, any of the major sports, they always had a double indemnity clause in the game.
Isn't that Harry Potter?
I was going to say it's more like basketball. That sounds like the
basketball.
Basketball, yeah. But like it's a normal game, but there's one rule. There's a few little things that can take off and you automatically win.
I like that, yeah. It'd be like Tampa Bay, if you hit the balcony, your team automatically, if a ball hits the balcony in the dome of Tampa Bay, instead of that being a home run, you just automatically win.
Automatically win. But it's got to be a little bit more complicated. Like, because in double indemnity, they're like statistically finding things that don't happen.
Oh, yeah. So it's got to be go onto the balcony and not come down.
Oh, that right. Does happen. Yeah, that's happened once or twice.
Mm-hmm. Or like, it's got to hit the balcony and then the outfielder has to catch it and then that team wins. Like, it's got to be like a few steps of.
Can the entire episode be just us coming up with this? This sounds like a lot of fun. We get to research historic ball fields and things like that. I think our audience would like that.
How about you, Tom? What would your adaptation be?
Well, you know what it is because I'm stealing it from UKJ, but I'm going to do the lottery ticket, the scratch-off lottery ticket, where if you get the double indemnity box, or if you get two lottery tickets that are winners within a certain period of time, you get twice the payout.
Yeah, but you don't just get it. You have to bring it to Keys and prove it to him. And he's going to actively try to convince you that you didn't win this lottery.
Yeah, I guess there has to be some kind of effort on your part. Like you have to get both tickets and get away with murder or something like that. Maybe like a bit of a challenge associated with it.
So now it's just turned into the Hunger Games, I think, isn't it? This is the Hunger Games.
We've just invented the Hunger Games. Congratulations to us.